Shoes.
Recorded live.
Oops. Hello, everyone. Hang on just a second here. Maybe having a bit of a problem. Hope everybody can hear me. I'm just checking something out. This is Rick. It is the 13th of September. We just got through with EMS, so if anybody that was at this past EMS is on the call today, welcome. I'm very, very, very glad you're here today. Let's see here. Something is wrong with my system, guys. So y'all hang on. I'm already late, I know, so thank you for your patience. I appreciate it. I'll just get up here, keep chatting for a second until I get this thing worked out, and so it'll play nice with me. Let's see. Where is that? Preferences. Okay. So that's working. Let's try that one more time and see if it works. It doesn't, so... So my system isn't playing nice this morning. So I had a busy day already, had a busy weekend. We had an amazing weekend with EMS. It was quite an experience. And for those of you who were there, again, just what a blessing to have you there. Looks like... Now it's working good. We can work now. All right. To our questions, and I'm sorry, we were having a very interesting staff meeting here before I got online. So our first question for the day is this. Our group recently discussed forgiveness. In that discussion, the topic of forgiving the affair partner came up, and various people indicated the difficulty with being able to do that. I actually had never thought of needing to forgive my wife's affair partner. I see my forgiveness needing to be towards her because it was her actions that hurt me or caused me hurt. I spent very little time even thinking about the APs, even because maybe because it was a delay of years in me finding out about both separate affairs. It just seemed so far removed, and in neither case did I really know them face to face, name, etc. Nor were they emotionally or long-term affairs. So, just how important is it to forget, to offer forgiveness when I don't even think of them except abstractly through my wife's actions? Super question. Thank you very much for that one. So I don't think it's necessarily relevant, and it really depends on a particular situation. I think that in reality, we only have to forgive those places where really there's an offense. If that affair partner is living rent-free in your head, and you're thinking about them all the time, and there's bitterness, and you want to, you're vengeful, and you want to extract something from them, and all of that, and you know, they're, if it's, you know, at that point, and it's personal, I think there's probably something to forgive. If on the other hand, like you just mentioned, it's not something that really bothers you, you don't think about it, I think that it may not be kind of that conscious act of needing to forgive. To me, the point that's important as we go through this thing, however, is that whole concept in my mind, I want to live in peace, which means that ultimately I always try to extend that vertical forgiveness to everyone. I mean, every day I do pray that prayer. You know, God, thank you that I never have a right to be offended by anyone. And it's not that people deserve my releasing them, but I release people so that I can have peace and live my life. I don't want to live in a place where every time I think of someone, and this is where I know that I need to consciously begin to try and let them go, where I hold resentment, and every time they come into my mind, you know, I surrender my peace and I immediately begin thinking about how I'm going to inflict pain or what I'm going to do to them or how I'm going to get Uncle Guido to come down and pop them upside the head. When that sort of thing is there, you know, the whole thing of still needing some sort of justice or whatever, I know that I still am holding that offense and I haven't been able to release it. So, and remember in the forgiveness discussion, there's two types of forgiveness. There's a vertical forgiveness and there's a horizontal forgiveness. I don't know that anyone, except under certain circumstances, would have that horizontal forgiveness or what we would call reconciliation or maintaining relationship or re-entering relationship with that person. And there would have to be several things on their part before that happened. The vertical forgiveness, you know, as Christ's example was, you know, the Father forgive them, they just don't know what they're doing. That one I try to extend to all people. But that forgiveness is a gift I give myself. It has nothing to do really with that other person. It's my release of them for my sanity and my ability to live and be who I think and who I know I am. So I hope that gives you a little bit of an idea. And it sounded to me in this question, the way you wrote it, that you really don't have, you're not holding an offense against them. You know, you're not, you know, you've let them go. You're not needing to do something against them. So that would be the proper type of, I think that would be the proper attitude that you've got. And so it's not something that everyone has to do either. So let's see here, the second question. Could you please explain that although there are different types of affairs, some physical with sex partners and others with cyber sex, emotional affairs, pornography, why they are all pitiful? Why their discovery or disclosure causes the same, or pitiful, painful, excuse me, I need to clean my glasses. Why discovery or disclosure causes the same shattering sense of self and or loss? You know, the reality is betrayal is betrayal. It really makes, some types of betrayal may be more complicated to deal with. Some types of betrayal go on longer than others. But when you look at it from the perspective that we are in a oneness relationship with someone, it's like taking those two cats and tying their tails together. But you know, we literally, that other person is a piece of who we are. They're a part of our soul. They're a piece of our identity, of our reality, of our history. Our mate is a part of us. We're one. That's what oneness means. So regardless of whether they're, you know, betraying us by virtual people, by actual people, whether it's a relationship of the heart, whether it's a relationship of the genitals, whether it's a relationship, it really doesn't make any difference. At some point, that person has looked beyond, you know, they've given to something else or someone else, something that ultimately they had agreed to be with you. And in that sense, that's going to create that incredible pain. Now, depending on the hurt spouse and how they see that, I mean, obviously, for some people, if they in their value system, and it's really about our schema, how we see life, and how we define monogamy and how we define infidelity. For some people, some of those behaviors may not even be seen as unfaithful. But typically, the unfaithful spouse, they certainly know, I think, when they're participating in a behavior that is not going to be acceptable to their mate, which is why, as we define infidelity, is the keeping of secrets, which is why, you know, they don't go talking to their mate about what they're doing because they know ultimately what's going to happen. And once that attachment bond is broken and we enter into that state of attachment distress or an attachment trauma, because now suddenly you're not there, there's really a ripping and a tearing of our reality, of our identity, of our sense of what is literally is almost a shift, and that's very painful. So that's really why it makes no difference what type of affair. I mean, oftentimes the one night stand is as painful to that person as the person whose husband has fallen in love with the next door neighbor, whose wife has fallen in love with somebody at church, or who's been looking at porn. All of them are that betrayal and looking to something else relationally. So hopefully that will answer that particular question. Now, next. Serial cheater versus sexual addiction. How can you tell the difference between a serial cheater, a person that enjoys their hurtful actions and doesn't truly desire to stop, and a sexual addiction? Have you had clients that pretended to have a change, a desire to change, but really didn't want, intend to? I know someone's true intentions will eventually be displayed, but I was wondering if you can spot this type of person compared to a sex addict. So that is a very interesting, I think, question. Here's why. So someone who's a serial cheater, I mean, just kind of philanderer, who's just always going out and doing things, may or may not have an addiction. I don't know if they do or they don't. Ultimately, until they come to the place where they suddenly decide and are convicted that they shouldn't be this way. They actually decide in their mind, in their head, because this, to me, the person that you call the serial cheater, at one level has found a way, probably they're not trying to control it. At least that's what I would count it, the philanderer, that's what I would look at. Most people, like, I never knew I was addicted till I finally came to, you know, the crisis that caused me to have to begin to stop and control it. And it wasn't until I finally decided that it had to be controlled that I suddenly realized that I didn't control it, that ultimately it did control me. So I think that that is a... you know, that's a tough one. So, you know, like I said, I guess that rarely do I see people that have a desire to change. They're just pretending that they really want. Now, they may not really want to give up what they're doing. What I really see more in answer to that piece of it is an ambivalence. So I think there's a part of them that's really ambivalent about change. And for all of us, remember, there's always two sides. There's flesh and spirit. There's mind and emotion. And so part of this, you know, I think anybody wanting to change, I mean, it's like if someone has a problem with anger at one level, they may think, oh, I know this is a problem, we'll need to change. But on the other hand, you know, the other person really deserves it. The thing can be different. You know, on one hand, I know I need to stop this. But on the other hand, I think, you know, I'm not really hurting anyone. So I think we will always struggle. I mean, the motivations of why we change are kind of what you're getting down to, and there's two sides. It's not black and white. And hopefully people just come to the place where they're tired of hurting other people, and they want to grow in love, and they want to begin to love other people and not hurt other people anymore. And the way I spot someone who's a philanderer, if they're not what we call egodystonic, if they see nothing wrong with what they're doing, they're not ever going to consider themselves an addict because they haven't come to the place yet where this has cost them enough. They're still in that what we talked about, I think, in relapse prevention. They're still in that pre-contemplated stage where they're not even considering that there's a problem with all of this. So hopefully that'll be a good answer to that particular question. Now, let's get to the next question. The long one. Rick, after 10 months of begging my husband to come back, and him saying that he loved me but didn't know why he couldn't come back. Finally, I know the reason. I just found out that all this time he's been living with his affair partner. I was praying for God to reveal what was in the darkness. Last week, his affair partner texted me saying that they were living together and getting married in December. He denied all of that. I decided to confront him one last time, and he admitted that he was still with her. In my heart, I knew that he was not being honest about everything, and that there is more that I don't know. I guess this is enough information for me. I said that we were going to officially separate, and that I was going to cut off all communication with him until I decided to call him back. I said he needed to seek God and get help. At the end of this conversation, I decided to ask him for the last time, are you willing to come back tomorrow to our house? To my surprise, he was silent and said, maybe. I was devastated and said, this is it. We're cutting off all communication and officially separating. He left the house. Then that night, he started texting me, calling me throughout the entire night and said that he had something important to say. I answered and he said that he'd really thought through his answer to my question and that he wanted to come back to the house, to me because he loves me, but not to her. I know that he's bound to her, wants to get out, but he can't, alone, but he can't. He said that he will sleep on the sofa, but please let him come back. I said no, and I needed to let him go in order to heal. I reminded him that I'm not divorcing him. Now I have a storm in my heart. I don't know if what I did was correct. Should I take him back? Absolutely not. And the reason I would say that, and again, pray, I am not God. I would do what God says. But the problem with somebody who's contemplative, where they want two things badly, and back to that change cycle, the first stage is pre-contemplative, and that's where the other person doesn't even see that there's something wrong with what they're doing. The next stage of change is called contemplative. And in the contemplative stage of change, it's always about being 50-50. Half of them wants to, it's two diametrically opposed positions. He wants her, he wants you. He can't choose. He wants both at equal amounts. You know, if this one says they're leaving, he goes to the one that's leaving. And then, you know, when the next one says, I'm breaking it off, then he goes, because he's got to stay somewhere in the middle between the two. There is such insanity in that particular dance. Typically, the only person who can make a decision in that sort of situation is going to be the hurt spouse, not the one who's caught between what I call the wahs and the ahs. And because this has gone on for so long, and he's been lying for so long and secretive for so long, my message to him would be, you know, I'm moving on. If at some point you break off this relationship and you can show me there's a significant amount of distance between you and the other person and you still are interested, you know, we can talk at that point, but until I would know for certain that that relationship and that person is out of your life, there's no way. And then I would, you know, as I told somebody this morning, I would just say the ship just pulled out of the dock and I'm moving on. And I don't know what you're going to do. Only time will tell. And then I would just begin to consider the reality or live in the reality that he's not coming back. And then, you know, if he does, if you still want to be with him, that will be great. But the probabilities of him being able to do that at this point without doing some really serious work are very, very slim. I mean, for him to have lied to you for 10 months and means he's got so much recovery work to do. So, you know, before he would ever really be safe, he would really have to show, I think, for a significant period of time, a separation from this other person, not something that's one night long. I have no idea if he saw her yesterday that he would be able, or day before yesterday was the last time he saw her, that he's really done with that relationship. I would know potentially if he'd gone 6 months and hadn't had any contact with her. or if he'd gone a year and hadn't had contact with her, that maybe he's done with that relationship. But that relationship, you would need to have good proof that that thing is done before it would, to me at least, feel, and he would have to be very, very, you'd need to see him working a really strong program of trying to heal himself. Most people in this position, what they try to do, they just try to do more of the same. They try to make everybody happy, and that's not what he needs to be doing. He would need to be focused on not making you happy and not even making her happy, but just really beginning to try to heal and figure out what's wrong with him, and really pursue wholeness, to pursue God. Because right now, if it's really about just trying to save the relationship, that's no change. He hasn't changed directions at all. That's what he's been doing for forever. If it's about trying to grow up and begin to consider what he's doing to other people, learning to be authentic and learning to be honest and not lying, and if he's developed a whole new group of friends, if he's doing, those types of things, if he's doing that, yeah, maybe there's change. But I'd like to talk to you about that farther down the line, even before I could tell you whether or not I feel like he would be safe. Because what he's done is very scary to me. And he's not safe right now, and he wouldn't be safe if he's on the couch, in the least. He's got to do a lot of work before he'd be safe. So I wish I could give you maybe the answer you wanted to hear, but that's certainly how I personally feel about it. He's not in recovery. Hope that helps a little bit, and I'll be praying for you. So let's go on now to the next question. Paranoid. My spouse and I have been in recovery for his addiction and my codependence since full disclosure in April. He took a polygraph test to confirm that all the secrets were out yesterday. We went to the grocery store to change our coins to dollars, and there were a couple of Jamaican coins. There were coins from Canada and Europe, which makes sense because he travels to Italy, Canada for work. His AP was in Italy and Canada. He's never been to Jamaica. He says he doesn't know how they got there. What do you think? Am I naive to believe him? How could they have ended up in our jar of coins? We had a really good polygraph. I just want to trust my spouse and not be stupid. So part of the problem, obviously, when we go through this sort of thing, is it is difficult at best to believe what you see, especially if so much of what has been feels like it's been a complete lie to you. So I get that. At the same time, if he's done a polygraph, and there are ways that coins can end up someplace, I think, besides someone having an affair in Jamaica. Do the due diligence you feel like you need to do, but for all you know, potentially in this sort of situation, potentially somehow the coins came through you. I don't know for sure, but that is certainly a possibility. So again, I feel bad about the paranoia that comes from that sort of thing. It is really, really scary. But at the same time, I don't think there's any way of knowing whether or not he somehow did something. So certainly I think that there could be truth in what he just said. I hope you're able to find the answers to that. Hang on just a second. There we go. Yeah, and it's, sometimes it'll even happen with an email. Do the due diligence, but unless you can somehow connect dots, I always keep my eyes open. In that situation, I'd say there's lots of explanations, and it's not necessarily this. Pray about it, and hopefully it would come out, but there's reasons to believe it's not. So, next question. Codependency. How am I supposed to express myself if my spouse isn't doing his program, going to meetings, when that was a part of our agreement in terms of what was going to make me safe? We're really busy, but is that an excuse? Well, and again, I don't know how long someone in this situation may or may not have been going to meetings. I think that if it's a matter of time, and I think if I told Stephanie in my recovery that if she didn't see me doing certain things that she needed to file for divorce, and those were working program, and kind of the things, I mean, I knew there were specific things I had to be doing. And I wasn't anticipating that she was going to file for divorce if I didn't go to meetings for 2 weeks because we had other activities that were conflicting. At the same time, if it became a pattern over a period of a month or 2 months, then, you know, I think she would have been radically concerned and we probably would have had a talk about it. If there's, you know, and at times I know that I kind of made the decision I needed to do something a bit different, but that was always something that was discussed between the two of us simply because I wanted to keep her in that loop of what I was doing. Not that I wanted her to be directing or creating my program, that wasn't the point, but I wanted her to know what to look for in a sense, because I wanted to know whether she's safe or she's not safe. And, you know, I would hope that your mate would sit there and begin to consider maybe what the outcome or what the impact of that is, and that y'all could have some good conversations, because I just think being able to talk about it and process what's going on is going to be important. You might want to talk to your therapist about that if you're a marriage therapist, and see if or he may need to talk to his therapist or his sponsor to figure out what he needs to be doing program-wise, and because he's got to work his program. So hopefully he's doing what he needs to do. Okay, appropriate boundaries. Is it okay to put my 10-month-old baby in the shower in the morning with me? My spouse and I have discussed how my mom was never ashamed to be naked in front of me and my sister growing up. My dad was never naked in front of us, but it got us talking about appropriate boundaries. Is it not appropriate that my mom was naked in front of my sister and me? I thought it was fine. We all feel very comfortable naked in front of women, and I'm comfortable naked in front of my spouse. Boy, you're going to get into a lot of opinions on this one. Just my personal opinion, I'm glad that you're comfortable with your body. I think it's important to be comfortable with your body. I think that with a 10-month-old baby, your body is not a problem for that at all. I mean, obviously there comes a point when there's an awareness with a child that it does begin to be a problem with someone, I think, with the opposite sex and stirs all kinds of things. However, you know, I think that we need to understand that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and there is something incredible about the human body and the way that God has made us, and not that it's something to be flaunted, but it's something to be incredibly appreciated, not something to be ashamed of, nor communicated that there's something bad about it. In fact, you know, I think what God would say about it is, you know, behold, it's very good. You know, it's an incredible thing. So keeping, I think, good boundaries in terms of opposite sex as they get older, might be aware, things like that. But being comfortable, no, I don't see anything wrong with that personally. There's some good material to read about that. I know that Restoring the Pleasure has a good section on that, The Gift of Sexuality. There's several books, I think, that you might be able to look at on children and sexuality. But in answer to that question, not a problem. Let's see. See, I'd like to share with you a couple episodes I had with my mother and like to know how they have influenced my sexual health. One episode is about my mom asking me where the cat was, and I accidentally went to the bathroom with my dad. My mom's next comment to that was, "Oh, well, the cat won't be shocked then," referring to my dad's size, let alone that I don't know my dad's size, and I believe the size is generally passed from father to son. I believe I was too small. It gave me quite of an unjustified complex for many years. Another episode was during one of my parents' fights when they were had stopped talking to each other for days, if not for weeks. My mom told me she was irritated that my dad would try to approach her in bed to have sex, but she would feel disrespected, so she would totally refuse him when she was in her early 20s. Before I was born, she was sexually molested in her office, and more than once she told me that she didn't like to be touched, including by the OBGYN. What kind of boundaries did she break, and is sharing such personal sexual information with your adult son healthy at all? So first off, sharing that sort of information with a child is in no way healthy. I mean, that's called spousification. It's a form of emotional incest, as far as I'm concerned. It is putting a child in a position that they are really not capable of handling. And in some ways, again, it's spousifying a child and talking with the child about something that they should talk to their spouse about. The same thing even with an adult woman talking to her son. You know, that seems, I mean, part of me would immediately, if my mom had tried to talk, I said, you know what, Mom, that stuff you need to be taking up with Dad, that is not stuff that is appropriate for me. And that would just kind of be my point, because when, again, there's almost like a splitting or a triangulation. I think it would be very difficult for an adult child of the opposite sex to kind of handle that with their parent. I mean, maybe you would have kind of a special gift to do that, or there'd be an opportunity. But first off, she ought to ask your permission to even talk about that stuff, even if she did, and you have a right to say, I don't even want to hear about that, and I don't want to be a part of that. Because it actually creates so many problems at so many levels. So, no, I don't think it's appropriate. I would hope, it sounds like that she... You know, she might benefit from talking to somebody and working through some of those particular issues. I think, you know, it would almost indicate to me, though, that she may not have friends that she feels comfortable talking to or able to talk to in a situation like that, and maybe someday she could find someone. But, again, parents of the opposite sex talking to even adult children, out of respect, the parent ought to at least say, can I talk to you about something? And it ought to be in a way, first off, that you know what it is, but just laying it on you, because, again, it potentially triangulates you. They need to be dealing with their marriage problems in another place, and especially their sexual problems. Sexual topics with kids. We've got a whole series of sexual things going here. Are there boundaries between moms and daughters that are more open than between mothers and sons when discussing personal sexual experiences or sex in general? I have a 10-month-old son who is wondering if there will be a more open communication between him and my husband instead of between us because we're of the opposite sex. You know, one of the things my mom did that I think was very, very useful is she tried to teach me some about women. But she didn't try to teach me about men in that sense, and she didn't try to teach me through my father, and she didn't try – she just kind of tried to let me know a little bit about women, but not in an inappropriate way, not using even herself as an example. I think that there may be a place where hopefully there's a – you know, again, if you raise a child in an environment where you see our sexuality as something to be celebrated, an incredible gift, nothing shameful. It's really a matter of how you look at a person, not about not looking. It's, you know, probably there's going to be an openness or an ability. If they feel unjudged, they may have questions they want to ask, but it's usually about their questions and the ability to answer the question. The person that's going to be able to far better understand and give direction, I think, is still the parent of the same sex. But if you've got a good enough relationship where, not that you're trying to force it on them, but you let them bring it to you and you're able to appropriately give them information, you become a safe source for that, I think that can be an incredible blessing for a child. But again, like we were saying earlier, you don't want to begin using your relationship kind of as the example and pulling them into your marriage. I think that would be very, very, well, I think that's difficult because it puts them in a position of almost having to choose at some point, and it affects their sense of identity. So that part, I think, is inappropriate. Well, we've got a bunch of questions today. Compartmentalization. Could you please explain how men could make love to their wives and still be unfaithful? I've heard about compartmentalization, but it still confuses me how feelings could just be turned off and on. If you don't mind me asking, when you were active in your addiction, were you able to face your wife and not think about what was you were doing? I've heard you share your story the night that God confronted you about your problem. How were you able to be around both of them, your wife's friend and yourself, and not join the two worlds? I don't know exactly how you explain sight to someone who is blind or color to someone who is blind. It's not something, I think, in the compartmentalization that you intentionally choose to do so that, you know, I could say, like, how I wiggle my ears. It was something that, I don't know how I did it. It's an interesting question. It was just the way something I was able to do. I just looked at those two different things. It was in a different area of the brain. It's funny because at EMS this weekend, that was actually one of the topics, the whole topic of compartmentalization and how did we end up, some of the wives were just trying to get their mind around how they could still want to be in the relationship with them and do that and do what they had done. And I think, you know, and you've probably heard me say this before, that's probably one of the most difficult things for some females to understand, simply because if they were to do the same thing, because they don't compartmentalize, they would have to completely have disconnected from the relationship, especially if they're egodystonic about being unfaithful, if it's against their morals or their value system. They would have to get to the point where they really didn't care about their mate, be incredibly angry at their mate, whatever, be able to justify it, and then they would do it because they wouldn't be able to be unaware. They would know ultimately, be thinking about the consequences and what's going to happen potentially. The guy can compartmentalize and do it, and honestly, not even really in that moment of insanity, not think about it. In fact, he just kind of does it and doesn't think. I wish I could give a better answer. I just don't know how to explain green to someone who's blind, and maybe somebody, you know, on the forums can do a better job of explaining compartmentalization. All I can say is when you ask specifically, like at that, you know, when we'd be around my affair partner, my wife and I, I was usually in the compartment at that point of the affair. I wasn't in the compartment with my wife, and the way I did it was, my wife was over here, but I was kind of in that place of wanting this, or the want was kind of the addictive piece, and so I was really not focused at all. So it was a lack of focus back on my mate, but I always knew how to kind of do the dance or look good or, you know, appear to be somewhat connected, but really I wasn't considering her at that moment. All I was, you know, when I was around the affair partner, even if I was with my wife, the focus was still the affair partner, not my wife. That's pathology. And now it would be really hard to do it, because I think that recovery goes a long way to beginning to rip down the boundaries of compartmentalization. Once upon a time, I could do something like that and not consider the consequences and see that. Now, I think that would be absolutely impossible to me, just because I think hopefully I've grown up enough that I wouldn't do that again, or I've grown up enough that I wouldn't be able to compartmentalize and to break it out. That's not good. Excuse me, my computer just did something it wasn't supposed to do. Just lost the next question. Okay. There we go. Good. Next question. Long. Restoring our sex life. What are the ways a person addicted to various aspects of sex addiction can restore a healthy sex life with his mate? Who has for years been secretly involved in affairs, emotional, sexual, secrecy, lies, online porn, live webcam porn, excessive masturbation, some sex desires and fantasies about watching the partner having sex with other people, having same sex, swapping, same sexual activities, and the list goes on. All of this, which, by the way, the partner had never been willing to participate in. Our sex life has been suffering for years, but I had no idea why or what my mate was dealing with. Through the years, a few of these issues would sometimes surface in our sex life, but I always rejected these ideas, not disgracefully or by shaming my mate. I understand people have different desires. I just said I didn't want to. It didn't arouse me, and to me, emotional connection with my mate, feeling safe, and being alone with my mate was vital for me to enjoy sex. So I'm grateful this has been brought to light, although the cost of disclosure has been severely painful because of the prolonged time it has taken to disclose everything. I understand my mate was gripped with shame and fear of rejection if anyone would find out, and also that this behavior is not because my mate is a bad person, but one who needs help. We both need help. We're now faced with how to heal our sex life in different ways. It's been 2 years since D-Day, 2 weeks from what I feel was, and 2 weeks from what I feel was final disclosure. I was about to give up, but now I really want to stand by him, and that is all, now that this has all been brought to light, and I feel a lot safer now that he's taking responsibility for his part of our relationship and his problems. We're both in 12-step recovery groups working with our sponsors. We've also been working hard on our relationship and communication, including 911, and things are much better, and it shows in our sex life. But we're still kind of at a loss in the sexual department and fear, the fear of what is okay and what is not. He's still dealing with fantasies and wandering eyes and relapses and masturbations and porn several times. The only sex therapist in our area is an avid spokesperson of using porn to enhance a couple's sex life. Says the problem with porn is not the porn, but how we as a society look at it, and that we should just seek and demand more quality porn. Maybe she's right, but I already know how porn has wreaked havoc in our relationship, and it hadn't helped us grow together, but to grow apart. It's inhibited intimacy in our marriage, and has left me feeling objectified and alone. Even during the years that I didn't know how he was using it, I was mainly the target of his fantasies, of my having sex with other men, porn images. Through the years, I've tried to talk with him about how I felt about him using these fantasies in our sex life, but he couldn't stop. I guess he was too lost in his addiction. It stopped for some weeks or months, but then began again. It eventually resulted in me withdrawing from sex in the last months, during which his final sexual affair was going on. I even gained weight to feel less attractive. After he was caught, I was blamed in therapy and by him and and by him for our relationship to fail because of him feeling so alone when I only wanted to have sex 1 to 2 times a week. My loneliness was not important, so important to deal with. So there are a lot of wounds we need to heal, but we're both willing to work on it. After D-Day, but before I knew what we were dealing with, the sexual addiction and everything my mate was involved in, I agreed to try to use porn because I was willing to explore. If I was just timid and had issues with it, well, I found out that I do have issues toward porn. I experienced the numbing excitement of it, but I don't like it, and it makes me feel worthless and objectified. So I said no. From that point, the truth about sex addiction began to surface. Anyway, since I've been feel very uncomfortable and unsafe going to this only available sex therapist in the area, can you give us some good advice on what path to follow? Recommended any reading, books, seminars, educational stuff. Thank you for everything ARC is doing. God is truly working through you. Okay, so one possibility, and I don't know if you want to do this, but actually John Haney here at our office is an ASECT therapist, but he is works from a faith-based perspective. ASECT is the American Association of Sex Educators, Therapists, and he's very, very good. And so if you just want someone to talk to, he would be an excellent person to begin to, if you want some counseling, at least you could do that potentially online or by telephone with him, potentially by Skype, doing video conferencing. In addition to that, I think getting the two of you going on a journey, maybe it's the best way to say this, of beginning to explore what we think sexuality is about, what it's going to be for us, kind of coming to a mutual, almost a new paradigm of maybe an understanding. I mean, I think this could be actually a very exciting journey between two people, just beginning to learn, explore, not the what we don't want to do, but ultimately what we do want to do. I know that one of the things in my journey of just trying to understand what is it really kind of changed even what I wanted to teach our kids, you know, because to me it's not about not looking or not doing something. It's about how I look and what I do. What is the true meaning? What is there something deeper than what I believe to kind of be the counterfeit that ultimately I bought into? What is eroticism? What do I do with those feelings if I find something arousal? How do we negotiate and enjoy the differences between the two of us? How do we come to know each other and still feel completely accepted and loved? A book I start for use oftentimes with Christians, helping them kind of begin that path, is Restoring the Pleasure. Sheet Music by Layman, I think, is a good book. I really like, just as a book to begin to understand something of sexuality, Snark's book, The Passionate Marriage. That isn't a Christian book, but it's very good. I think that, you know, after you go through some of those, if you want to understand some aspects of eroticism, if you feel like you're not on the same page on that, Esther Perel's book, Mating in Captivity, I think has some interesting material in it. And again, that one, for instance, isn't necessarily, again, from a Christian perspective, but I think she has an interesting exploration of eroticism and maybe other ways of looking at it. I think that another place to look, interestingly enough, in terms of a basis or a foundation that I find to be really good, is Pope John Paul's writing on the theology of the body in the 1980s, which I thought was just a great theological piece. And some places you might be able to look for that would actually be, if you look up Christopher West, he's probably got some CDs and things y'all could purchase and read, and you might find that to be very interesting material. Hopefully that gives you enough resources, though, where you could begin the journey. And again, I would do this material together because this is a chance and an opportunity for the two of you to begin to develop something quite unique. It's special between this, a different understanding, and it's a great way to continue on in life and just kind of growing together. And if you can have an honest and open dialogue about it, that would be an incredible blessing. So with that, that's all of our questions for the day. Thank you for joining the Q&A call, and I look forward to talking to you guys next Monday. To healing. Bye-bye.